From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. For companies looking to expand or make a big move, not all states are created equal. So where does Georgia stand in the rankings of the most business-friendly states? The airport billboards and Governor Deal declare Georgia to be number one. If you consult Forbes magazine, however, Georgia comes in sixth. So what's being measured and what does that mean? To help us understand the rankings and the scouting process for businesses, Tom Smith is with us. He's professor at Emory's Goizueta Business School. Tom, welcome. Welcome.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well. Glad you could be with us despite the delayed school opening this morning. Also with us is Forbes senior editor Kurt Bodenhausen. Kurt, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Kurt, first of all, what do these lists actually mean?
That's a good question. We are not the only ones that do this, obviously, and Governor Deal, I think, is referencing another one of our competitors. But really, from our standpoint, this is not a perfect science by any stretch. There's different ways you can measure this. We use it really as a jumping off point, a conversation starter for people, and in particular for our readers, to get them interested in how these different states match up from their economic climates and their business potential.
So what are you measuring in that economic climate and business potential?
Well, from our standpoint, we look at six broad categories, 40-plus metrics, and we measure business costs. We look at the labor supply, regulatory environment. We look at the current economic climate, and then we look at the growth prospects of the state. And then the last thing we look at is the quality of life.
Tom, you, as a business professor, would you add anything to those metrics in that ranking?
Well, I haven't looked at the methodology that they use. I think that a lot of times when people are trying to identify what's important for businesses, they look at things like infrastructure, the ability for businesses and people to move around a city or a municipality or a state, tax climate, things of that nature, education of workforce. I do believe that you mentioned, the supply and demand of your labor, but also how educated your workforce is or how tech savvy they are. I mean, different companies have different needs, clearly. And so, if you're looking to have a highly educated or a tech-savvy workforce, that's one thing versus just pure number of people, that's something else. And so the methodology and, how you're weighting each one of these categories makes a big deal as to, where a state would fall on a ranking list.
Kurt, how about criteria like quality of life? You said that was a measurement, but how do you actually put a number on that? Cost of living, for example, cost of housing, the amount of time you spend on the road commuting.
Right. Well, those are all things we look at, actually. We look at cost of living. We look at commute times. We look at crime. We look at education. We look at the schools. We look at the health of the populace. And we also look at more general things like recreational and cultural opportunities in the state. But to Tom's point, every company is looking for something different. This is a broad ranking what we're looking at. There is a big difference between Intel locating a multi-billion-dollar microprocessor plant and a five-person startup.
Right.
They're very different things, or a distribution center, an Amazon distribution center. I mean, you're looking at very different things in terms of the technical skills you need, and when you're measuring states, there's also very different areas within a state. So California. We measure California, and they finish in the middle of the pack. But California is a very diverse state. I mean, it's in the top 10 economies in the world if it was just a country by itself. And California has vastly different areas across the entire state.
Right. I noticed that you also have rankings for cities, for example, and then places for small business. So as you said, it's a conversation starter. But what role do the local municipalities, city governments, state governments play in that kind of conversation? For example, willingness to create tax incentives for businesses. Where do those conversations begin?
Well, I think that you know, whenever a large company, I mean, right, your colleague just mentioned large companies coming into the state, those conversations always have to start with the governor's office. They always then trickle down to, you know, whoever the leaders are of individual municipalities. You know, and people understand large organizations are talking to each other to say, oh, these are the kind of tax incentives. This is what they're willing to give you. These are the kind of, you know, these are the kind of zoning regulations that they're willing to forgive, or these are the kind of easements that they're willing to negotiate, what have you. For a smaller company, you know, those kind of conversations are happening at the, you know, and the community grassroots level, where you say, oh, this is North Fulton Chamber. And they say, yeah, we've got great people here. We'd love to have you move into Alpharetta. We'd love to have you move into Sandy Springs. And the governor's not making a phone call for, you know, for a 10-person operation. And so, you know, the level of interaction is very dependent on, you know, how many billions of dollars you're going to bring to a state.
Well, of course, there have been movements in some places to Boston, for example, to not host the Olympics, not draw them in with all sorts of incentives, or to not be a contender for Amazon's HQ2. So is it that the citizens of the state, there's a little bit of NIMBYism going on, they just don't want it in their backyard? Or do you think they really have a sense of the cost of not having these kind of big businesses in the state?
Well, I think, you know, from the ranking standpoint, I just think the state used these as marketing tools. But in terms of attracting big companies, I mean, every community attracting a big business isn't necessarily a positive. One, if you're going to roll out the red carpet and the incentives don't make it worthwhile. I mean, the incentive game, you know, I don't think incentives is first on the list in terms of what companies are looking at, but it certainly sweetens the pot. And we saw it with the Amazon situation, which has put economic development and site selection at the forefront with this beauty pageant over the past year plus. But attracting a big company obviously isn't perfect for every community. And I think a lot of residents worry. You bring up the Olympics, which is a very good point. The infrastructure of many communities cannot handle a large influx of workers, or in this case, a large event that's going to attract tens of thousands of people to the city.
Yes, yeah, if I can echo.
Yeah, please.
If I can echo a little bit of that, you know, I heard a report on your station after Amazon had announced where they were going to move, that people who are already living in those communities are saying, wait, this is going to push me out of my community. You know, the cost of my living is going to go up, or the cost of my apartment or condo or house or whatever else. What's going to happen to real estate? What's going to happen to traffic? So there are different people have different incentives and different motives, and they might see like a business development as being a negative for them. So the whole, you know, not in my backyard kind of mentality, where, you know, the governor's office says, look, we're going to increase the tax base. Your tax burden is going to go down. But if all of a sudden, you know, this company's moving into my neighborhood, I say, yeah, but my traffic is going to go up. My commuting time is going to go up by 30 minutes. I can't find a parking place at the local grocery store. So everybody's perception as to the benefits and costs of business moving in are different depending on where you're standing on that spectrum.
Well, I'm wondering, as an academic, have you ever seen an analysis of that, how much the cost of incentives versus additions to tax base has actually manifested?
Well, there are lots of studies as to what happens with, let's say, real estate pricing as a result of businesses moving in, or what happens to commuting time as a result of businesses moving in. And then almost all of those analyses then have to identify, well, how much weight or how do you value, let's say, the commuting time versus the reduced tax burden, right? Mm-hmm. Or how do you weight or how do you value the cost of living going up in an area? So you say, well, house prices just increased by 10% because it's become a very attractive neighborhood. Well, if I'm currently living in the neighborhood, that's terrific for me. But if I'm trying to move in the neighborhood, that's awful. So again, you know, in academic settings, you also have to put value on things that are very difficult to value.
So I'm wondering, elected officials do love to boast about Georgia's success in business, but local politics can also deter companies. I'm wondering, Kurt, from your perspective as an outsider, how is Georgia regarded in this way?
I think Georgia is regarded as having a very strong business climate. You've seen a lot of companies move to the area. I mean, it has a lot of existing big company headquarters in the area. And the growth prospects are strong. If you look at forecasts over the next 5 years, job growth is expected to be strong. You're expected the Georgia's economy is expected to grow among the top 10 in the country over the next 5 years. So I think that the business prospects from an outsider and from economist standpoint, Georgia looks very strong.
What do you think, Tom? What do you see from inside the state?
Yeah, I mean, I've been bullish about Georgia and Atlanta for a number of years. I mean, I come from the Midwest. I moved here about 11 years ago. And, I was very skeptical about, moving my family from Chicago to Georgia. But the truth is that this is a great place to raise a family. It's a great place to do business. My wife opened up her business here. And the truth is that most of the time you will find the interaction between business leaders and chambers and politicians to try to have lots of synergies. Like, how can we make this so that this business has more opportunities? There's always little, potholes in the road, if you will. But the truth is that
quite literally,
quite literally. But Georgia is a terrific place to do business. I'm very bullish about Georgia. I think that everybody should move their family.
So, Kurt, we didn't get number one. So, what made North Carolina number one over Georgia, for example?
North Carolina has been a consistent performer for us near the top. One of the big differences from our measurement really comes down to cost of doing business. We lean on Moody's Analytics for their cost of business measurement, and they've got North Carolina 10% below the national average, where Georgia is only 2% below the national average. So that's a significant difference. And when you get talking about between number one and number six in terms of overall rank, that there's a little bit of granularity there where that's not actually a huge swing. But both states have a lot of very strong things going for them, with a good labor supply, very business-friendly regulatory environment, as well as strong growth prospects.
Well, Kurt, we're not, no offense to you, but we're not taking down those posters at the airport that say we're the number one state to do business.
Fair enough. Keep them up.
And Tom Smith will be there helping us paste them. Kurt Bodenhausen, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
He's senior editor for Forbes magazine. Recently, among their rankings for doing business, the top 10 states to do business, Georgia was number six. And Emory business professor Tom Smith, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And now just ahead, why so many Georgians struggle to pay off Christmas debt. But first, a new Atlanta bookstore specializes in rare and classic African-American books. This is On Second Thought. We'll be back after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. For Keeps, a shop for rare and classic black books, opened in November on Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. Owner Rosa Duffy wants to make the shop a community space to explore the history of black literature and publishing, and she's joining us now in the studio. Rosa, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thank you
very
for having me.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. I have to say, we became absolute fans of your Instagram feed when we saw all those great pictures of books.
Thank you so much.
There is a certain aesthetic. It looks to me like there's a lot of 60s and 70s era books? Is that what was the draw for you there?
Yeah, so we definitely have a lot of older books, stuff that's harder to get your hands on than maybe stuff that's been published recently. So yeah, our focus is in 60s, 70s, but we still have stuff that range from then to now. So it's not only that, but it definitely, we cover that as a niche for sure.
So I guess your parents were huge influences on your love of literature.
They definitely were. So my family has very strong roots in the civil rights movement in general. So my grandma on my mom's side was involved very much in the fair housing projects in Minnesota. That's where she lives. She's also very involved in voter representation. My dad helped to build what kind of Black Atlanta is today back when he went to Morehouse. My mom went to Spelman, and she was one of the first Black women to get a dual degree at Spelman and Georgia Tech in STEM. So my family has always been very involved in Black representation and the Black message. And for that reason, you know, Black books are a part of that. So
yeah. So what was the message about the importance of books, especially by Black authors?
Well, I don't know if I was I don't know that I'm acutely aware of how they involved Black books and their importance in society in general, but Black representation and the Black message was something that was very instilled in me at a young age, and that obviously includes Black books. So my family had a big library. My grandma has still, to this day, has a huge library that I'm still trying to duplicate for the store. So it was everything, not just books, not just imagery, but everything. My dad was also a speechwriter for local Black politicians like Andy and like Maynard Jackson. So, you know, speaking the Black message was also something that was very, very instilled in me at a young age. So books help to represent that.
I like that you call him Andy.
Yeah. Oh, I call him Uncle Andy, actually. But Andrew Young, yes.
So you're deeply steeped in this this part of Atlanta culture, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And which was, of course, all of Atlanta, which is not a sort of niche.
Right.
But how about pivotal books in your life? One that I saw a photograph of was Angela Davis's Women, Race, and Class. What about why did that stick with you?
So Women, Race, and Class was really important to me because I read it at a time that I really needed it. So I lived in New York for 8 years, and around 18 or 19, I read that book when I was starting a project, because I'm an artist as well. I was starting a project called Defend Black Womanhood, and Defend Black Womanhood was where I would weep paste around the city passages from books and photos of young Black men and women killed by the police. So it was to represent and commemorate Black folks that I feel like hadn't been seen at the time because it was so early. Doing that, I felt a lot of things that I didn't necessarily know how to express, and I didn't know that other people had felt these things. So when I read Women, Race, and Class, it helped to reassure me that what I was doing was necessary and that folks had already done it before me. And that's really why I love reading, is because I feel reassured. Really, that's what I tell people, is that I feel like, okay, I'm not alone in this fight. This fight has been done for many, many years, and many people before us have worked very hard to get where we are today. And in order to fulfill what we really want in society, we need to be reading what folks have done before us, the steps they've taken, and kind of take it from there, not just think, you know, I'm the first person to run this rodeo and I know what I'm doing. And I kind of felt reassured and humbled when I read that book. Like, this has already been done. And in order to, you know, fulfill it, you gotta make sure you're paying homage to the folks that have done it before you.
I want to go back to, you said your work as an artist. A lot of your work had been using found paper materials and old newspapers. So not entirely surprising that you found your way here. But how did you go from there to deciding to open a bookshop in Atlanta? What was that decision-making process?
So, right. I lived in New York for a long time, like I said, 8 years, and I was sourcing materials from everywhere. So, like you said, a lot of periodicals, a lot of old newspapers, from a lot of Atlanta Daily Worlds, everything. I would use everything as a resource for my artwork. And when I would find something new, I would get really, really excited about it, and I would feel like, wow, like I said, I'm represented in a way that I've never seen before. And it ranged from, like I said, periodicals to zines, from, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. When I would find something new, I thought, wow, this is such a great feeling. And I knew that other folks would feel the same way. And so I knew that I wanted these things to be shared and not just hoarded and kept to myself. I knew that it could bring a light to other people. If it made me feel this way, it could definitely make other folks feel this way. And that's kind of what led me to opening the store / reading room, is the feeling I felt when I would get my hands on something.
You've also said that you don't really think people have to purchase anything.
Right.
But I'm guessing that was not like the number one point on your business
right.
plan.
Right. My number one point wasn't make a profit. Absolutely. But that's obviously important. I want to keep the space open. I want people to be able to come back and over the years. So it's important to make money. But I really want the interaction to happen that has been happening in the store. I've witnessed it over the past month, is that people will come in, they'll read something on those. So we have a table with the materials that aren't for sale, and mm-hmm. we have a few benches with materials that aren't for sale. And people have looked in it and either found a connection to their hometown. You know, there are a lot of folks that aren't from Atlanta, Black folks that are here to, you know, help build a community, and they feel seen here. So they come into the store, they see something, you know, from Kentucky or from Ohio or from, you know, so they make a connection with these rare materials, and then somebody will come in the next day and use the same rare material to make a connection. So I didn't want to sell these things so that there could be multiple connections made and that people could get their hands on stuff that they might not necessarily even realize they want their hands on.
So it's a little bit like a library in
a way. It's a little bit like a library, yeah.
But you can't take the books away.
But you can't take the books home.
You have to stay and hang
out.
Yeah. Well, I guess that is the point. But some of the books that you have acquired were rare, right? And priced as such. Others buried at the bottom of a bargain bin. So,
right.
So what has that been like to uncover some of these famous authors and put them on display?
I get very excited when I find something that I've been wanting for a while. I just recently found, I already have a copy, but it's my copy at home, Love Poems by Sonia Sanchez, and I wanted another for the store because it made me feel some type of way when I was upset and I read Love Poems. Even seeing the cover, and because I'm an artist, the cover is very important to me. So I see them all as little pieces of artwork. And when I found Sonia Sanchez and then realized it was signed inside, I felt like everybody could have a personal moment with the book. That's been really exciting. Even finding classics that different, I have a bunch of the Souls of Black Folks. I have a bunch of different copies with different covers. I just think the whole experience is really exciting and fun.
What's the response from people who come in? I mean, do people walk in off the street?
So my sister actually tweeted it after I only announced that I was opening the store a day before it opened. So I didn't do a great job marketing, but my sister tweeted it out. So we got a lot of response from my sister and her Twitter audience. A lot of folks have come in. Her name's Josie Duffy. I just want to give her a plug. Josie Duffy Rice. But she put it out there. And then a lot of folks have been coming from the street. We did a great sign artist painted our window, and it attracts a lot of people. His name is Lonnie. He did a great job. So a lot of folks have been coming off the street, but Atlanta has been treating me so well. Atlanta already has a sense of appreciation for their Blackness. We already have a huge community here. You know, folks call it the Black Mecca. So I feel very humbled and honored to be on Auburn Ave, which has such a history behind it, and have people come in and be so helpful and loving and encouraging, and also, you know, tell me about their story and their book collections. And it's been very much a give and take. It's not just me putting something in the community that everybody can use. People have given me a whole bunch since I've been there. So it's been great.
That is Atlanta native Rosa Duffy. She's the owner of For Keeps. It's a bookstore of rare and vintage books on Auburn Avenue by African-American artists primarily. But not exclusively,
right?
Certainly,
it's just about the Black experience.
Exactly. So let's talk about creating that space. However, when you were dreaming of it, what did you want it to feel like?
You said your grandma's library,
right? So my grandma's library had a lot to do with it. But even I spoke to her about what I wanted the space to be like. And when I was a little bit nervous opening, I asked her, you know, some of her advice, and she was telling me, treat it as your home. So a lot of this stuff you already have at home, you're very familiar with. Just treat it as an extension of your home and you trying to share. And when she said that, it was very, very helpful for me. You know, it helped me grow the store into what I really wanted it to be before I opened. So it's just a relaxed setting. I don't want people to feel intimidated by the materials, because I feel like in a lot of spaces, they're behind glass, or they're $800, or they're this or they're that, and they feel really untouchable. And I wanted it to be a space where there were comfy chairs, a relaxed atmosphere. You know, I play a lot of Charles Mingus in the store because it's relaxing, and, you know, it encourages you to kind of breathe and read and take in the material. So I just wanted it to be comfy. You know, I wanted it to be inviting.
So what are some of the books that have, you know, people have picked up? You said that there are some that you don't sell, but
right.
that people have really responded to.
So I have an old Black Scholar edition, or Black Scholar issue of the Black Scholar magazine, and it has a Shirley Chisholm interview in there about, I can't exactly remember, but the response from that article alone has been really big. People have been really, really interested in that. I just put out a small zine called Mainstream, and I think the edition is from the 60s. See, I get new stuff every day, so I get really, every day I'm excited about something new. So I'm talking about my most recent discoveries. And that Mainstream zine has a poem by Patrice Lumumba. So we have a range of everything, and people will sit at the table for, you know, going on. I've had people there until I close. It's just very, you get lost in all the stuff that's provided. And I have a bunch of old Jets too, which
Jet
I didn't
magazine.
Really, a Jet magazine. Uh-huh. I didn't really think that would be something that people responded to like they do, only because it's such a staple in Black homes that I didn't feel like this would be such a surprise to see. But people, I mean, I think it's a bit of nostalgia too. People just really are excited when they see the Jet magazines.
So the Lumumba is one that I saw.
Right.
It was on the Instagram feed.
Yes.
And if you can just remind listeners, he was a assassinated leader, elected leader of
right.
Congo at
right.
the time.
Of
it was
course.
Congo.
Yeah.
So not a figure that a lot of people know. So in a way, you are providing a community space, but is there a teaching sort of angle here? Are you sneakily teaching people?
Well, I definitely want people to expand their idea of Blackness and their idea of Black leaders, because I think, you know, the general population is taught about, you know, two or three very important people. It's not that they're not important, but we've gotten that message over and over, and we understand that message. And in the story, you can learn more about that message. But there's also other people that we need to know about. We need that, you know, the imagery to be broadened and understand that you can be this, you can be that. There's not two people. It's not a binary thing, and you get to choose from these two people, and that those are the people that represent you as a Black person. There's other people to learn from. So yes, absolutely. I do think I just want people to feel seen. That's
so
my whole thing.
It's funny, Rosa, when we were mic checking you, my producer asked, you know, what are you doing afterwards? And you're like, I'm going to open up books and, you know,
yeah.
check, put the price tags on books. Your life is
yeah.
very different.
Oh, yeah. So it's definitely different. So I've just been ordering I order every day. It's become an issue. And so, yeah, I'm trying to just get all my inventory out. I like people to see all of it.
You're a retailer now.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for speaking
thank
with us.
Thank you
and
so much.
Best of luck with the shop.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Absolutely beautiful space. Atlanta native Rosa Duffy, owner of For Keeps. It's a bookshop for rare and classic books on Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. The holidays are a time when many of us gather with our families, often around gigantic spreads of food. But for many, especially immigrants, family can be an ocean away. And that is when food and the memories it can prompt become powerful and even more meaningful. GPB's Grant Blankenship brings us this audio postcard about the power of food and nostalgia from the British Tea Room restaurant in the city of Warner Robins.
Flags not flying, we're like the Queen. She's not at Buckingham Palace, and we're not here either. My name is Jeanette Francis. What do I do? I cook.
38-12, dear, please.
We have a little tea room, and I do all the cooking in the back. I've been here over 30 years right now. Yes, I used to go home and stock up and come back. And then when my parents passed away, I thought, can't get my bisto for my gravy. So I opened the shop. It makes me feel warm and cozy to have a good English meal. because you miss it.
It's like looking at old photographs. I am Elizabeth Douglas, or Lizzie Douglas, and I've been working here with Jan for 4 years, nearly 5 years. Deep down, it's the proper English Sunday dinners, a roast beef Yorkshire pudding, roast potatoes, mashed potatoes, as many vegetables as you can get on your plate, and proper meat gravy. It just takes you back. When you do a nice gravy, it takes you back to, like, your mum used to make. And it just gives you a warm, fuzzy feeling.
Things that fly off the shelves right now are sausages, bacon, mince pies.
My mum's still alive. She's 84 on the 6th of December. So that'll be a time when I just want to give my mum a hug. And everybody's fine. It's just, I just miss being with them. As we all do. And to be honest with you, if I hadn't found the British Pantry and Tea Room 4 years ago, whenever it was, then I don't know what I'd have done with my time. And it just gives you a warm, fuzzy feeling that you belong.
That was Jeanette Francis, owner of the British Tea Room in Warner Robins, and her friend and employee, Lizzie Douglas, on how food reminds them of home. Just ahead, getting funny with money. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until the 19th century, Christmas gifts were not exchanged until January 6th to celebrate the gifts of the Magi to the Christ child. That was long before PlayStations, Black Friday sales, and holiday spikes in airfare. Despite all the reminders of the reasons for the season, the giving and gathering and holiday cheer can, for many people, be followed by months of credit card bills. A report from creditcards.com finds the average household credit card debt in Georgia to be the seventh highest in the country, while the state has the 19th lowest median income. So, without getting all Scroogey on you, we're going to turn to our favorite podcast for some Christmas spending reality checks. Matt Gorin is a financial educator and co-host of the WUGA podcast, Nothing Funny About Money, and is joining us from Athens. Welcome, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks so much. So, Nothing Funny About Money, are we going to have, like, the sad trombone story here of Christmas?
Well, I'm sorry. You mentioned having the Scrooge version. I think I call myself a Scrooge. So
why?
If you were trying to avoid that, you shouldn't have had me.
Why
on.
Do you have it? Do you encourage your kids to go to the soup kitchen and help out and exchange homemade cards on Christmas? Is that what you do?
Well, I don't have children to do that to, but my focus really is more on those experiences like giving, certainly, and spending time with family and friends. More than giving gifts. I'm not so much of a gift giver.
Okay. So, all right. So we know that about you. But how about for other people who do buy gifts at Christmas? The conventional advice is you make a budget, you avoid using credit cards. Do you agree? I mean, what would you add to that?
I would add to that, maybe don't spend so much. Don't focus so much on giving such expensive gifts at all. If you're looking at the statistics on how much people are giving, we're now up to over $850 per year for the average American adult, and that's twice as much as it was just 10 years ago.
Well, there is a lot of stress, especially on parents, to give the toy of the moment or the pair of sneakers of the moment for their children. What do you hear from families who have had similar experiences and overspend?
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. It's this feeling that you have to give gifts, and that's part of our overall culture. I think, as you're saying, it's also how we express love to our children. Are you a good parent if you don't get your kid all the expensive stuff that they want? That's hard.
Right. And have you run into people who say that, you know, they went into debt at Christmas and they were really struggling with it?
Yes, many. So a lot of the work that I've done here in Georgia, besides the show, is focusing on the needs of lower income people. So we've had seminars out in the community. We see clients for free here at the Aspire Clinic. And it's very common for people to say, I had to go into debt. I had to give my kids these gifts, thinking I'm going to get some money back from my tax refund, or I don't know how I'm going to get it back. I got to figure it out. But it's so important to show that you can provide and you want to give these things to your kids.
Well, that's part of the thing that I enjoy about the show, that money is layered with meaning. It gets construed with self-worth and love. It's emotional. How do you counsel people who are dealing with not just, you know, the balance in their checkbook, but there's so much else going on?
One of the big things we do is just talk to people, and that seems so obvious once you say it. Why are you spending this money? What are your goals? What are you trying to get out of this? And for a parent who's saying, I need to spend all this money because this is what I want to provide for my kids. Well, do your kids actually want this stuff? Have you talked to your kids about what their big priorities are? And for some of these kids, what they might want is to see their mom and dad, to not have that parent feel like they need to work overtime or feel stressed out. They just want to hang out with you. And some of my fondest memories from when I was a kid is just playing football in the backyard with my dad. I wouldn't give up those memories for anything. I can't even recall what gifts he was buying me when I was a kid. That's all been forgotten. Hmm. But those experiences are going to stick with me forever.
Well, the messaging, though, for kids is pretty intense. And this is something you and your colleagues satirized in a little skit from your show, Nothing Funny About Money.
Hey, kids, I'm Bucky the cartoon character. Let's talk about spending money. Anybody here like candy? How about big old shiny toys? Boy, howdy! Did y'all watch that nice old television advertisement my employer recently aired during the Saturday morning cartoons? Boy, that's just super! We played on your fears of rejection while simultaneously arming you with the persuasive appeals necessary to separate your parents from their money. Anybody want some light-up shoes? Make sure to let Mommy and Daddy know. If they don't buy you the most expensive brand of merchandise, they don't love you. Now, who wants to go watch a movie sequel? All right, let's go.
You're bucking a pretty strong trend there, Matt Gorin. Are you concerned about the kind of messages kids get about spending?
I want to note that personal finance is very serious business. We don't mess around.
Bucky the Clown doesn't usually appear.
Yeah, we've now changed his title to Spokes Demon, so that should give you a sense of where our heads are at. I am kind of concerned about those messages, absolutely. That's why we included it in the show. If you haven't done this in the last few months or so, just watch a Saturday morning cartoon and check out some of those commercials that are now airing. I think a lot of parents might be surprised just how intense those ads are.
Well, haven't there been some movements, especially now that we have so many different online media and, you know, a lot of kids have little electronic devices that are communicating with them, even toys, you know, Barbie dolls, that kind of thing, to prevent those kind of messages to kids?
To the extent that there's some measures to block those things, to set up firewalls or parental controls, what every parent's also got to realize is their kids are at school, they're hanging out with their friends. By around age 10 or 11, parents take a step back from their kids' ideas about how the world works. Instead of parents, it's now their friends who are giving them the most information. So no matter what a parent's trying to do, if the other parents of these other kids aren't putting up those walls, their own kids are still going to be exposed to those messages.
Yeah, that's what I mean. There's so much peer pressure. So how do you instill? You said, you know, ask kids if they really want this. But how do you help them grow up with a sense of value, I guess, especially, you know, in a world where there are probably a lot of people who are far less fortunate than they are?
My advice is to show, don't tell. If you want your kids to be less materialistic, less focused on what the new toy is, live that life yourself. If you're telling your kids you shouldn't want the new PlayStation or whatever, but then you're driving around in the brand new sports car, what message are you really sending to the kids? Hmm. They're going to see that toys are important, that buying these expensive things is important. they're not going to be modeling these other behaviors like giving, focusing on the family, and so on.
Well, of course, it's not just kids. You know, a lot of people have a lot of expectations around the holidays and Christmas giving, Hanukkah giving, that kind of thing. Give us a little bit of that history. When did this start happening? You know, the kind of materialism taking over Christmas.
It started, the first glimmers of it, as I understand it, in the middle of the 1800s. And that can be traced back to the origins of shopping malls and shopping plazas. So consumerism was starting to ramp up during the Industrial Revolution. And of course, once you've got all these goods hanging around, then people need to be told to buy all these things. But as far as the modern version of this, we really can trace it more to the 1950s, 1960s, really expanded the size of the middle class, the amount of consumer cash that people have available to them. They don't need to spend it so much on the house anymore. We had a very strong economy back then. Instead, we can spend it on gifts and on stuff. And so we did. And if you look at shows like Mad Men, I think that does a great job of showing the changing culture around that time. There's this idea in that show of tell people that they need something, create a need, and they'll follow suit.
I'm speaking with the financial educator, Matt Gorin. He's also co-host of the WUGA podcast, Nothing Funny About Money. But it's not just the consumers. Christmas shopping is the be-all and end-all for retail. Our economy depends upon it, doesn't it, or does it?
Well, about one-fifth of all retail sales happen during the holiday season. So when you figure how short of a period of time that is, that's really a substantial amount of money. I don't know that it goes so far to say we need Christmas shopping or we need holiday shopping to make our economy run, but it certainly helps.
Well, you talk about gift cards in one of your episodes. $1 billion of money spent on gift cards every year that goes unused. So there's all this pressure to deliver and to give something for Christmas, but these gift cards, people just forget about them?
They forget about them. They're to stores that people have no interest in actually shopping at. Sometimes gift cards can expire. So if you're thinking, I'm going to spend that money on that big purchase a year down the line, 2 years down the line, it might be too late. The money's already gone.
And just after Christmas, about 10% of all gifts are returned. That's about $70 billion worth of merchandise sent back to the stores. So if you could help people rethink Christmas giving or holiday giving, what are some of the ways that you would do that?
There's a few practical bits of advice I've got. And one of them is limit the number of gifts that you're giving. People don't need to give so many things. There's a movement that says you should only give your children 3 gifts because that's how many gifts the wise men gave Jesus in the manger. And then if you look at holidays like Hanukkah, there's 8 nights, maybe you only give 8 gifts over that period of time. Versus the alternative, when you don't set a specific number, well, maybe there shouldn't be a limit. How much do you love your kids? Well, infinite love translates into infinite gifts.
And how about when then your neighbor brings over a gift for you and you think, oh, no, I didn't get anything from my neighbor?
Yes, I run into that quite a bit. So
as a Scrooge, I imagine that happens.
Yeah, I tell people, don't give me stuff. And yet here I am, the recipient of all their generosity, the nerve of these people. What I try to do as a return favor is buy them a meal, bring them a bottle of wine as they go over to their house. Or when I'm buying gifts that allow us to spend time together, like board games or video games. The idea being, I'm giving you this, say, poker chip set, so that we then start playing poker together. It's not just something that you can have on your own. This is a way to increase our social interaction.
But this has been something I've heard about a lot, you know, the movement towards non-material gifts, giving the gifts of time, giving, you know, a gift certificate for doing an errand for somebody. Do you think people really appreciate that, or they see it and think, oh, there's old Scrooge Matt Gorin?
Yeah, the gift
You're not going to live this one down, apparently, Matt.
No, the gift certificate for, like, the back massage, that seems very tacky to me. I think people who've gotten one of those might agree with that. But on the flip side, let's have me just spontaneously treat you to a spa day where I'm, you know, doing the massage without you having to ask for it. I think other things like just making the effort to travel and meet people. So as an example, this Friday, I'm heading up to Chicago to spend time with my best friend up there. I don't think I'm going to bring a gift. Maybe I should do that. But I am spending a lot of money and a lot of time to make that happen and to spend time with him.
Well, travel is one of those things that adds up at Christmas time, especially, you know, if you've got a family of four, family of five, buying tickets for everybody, that costs a lot of money. Is that one of those holiday pressures that you advise people against?
One thing that I advise people on is to spend time with each other. But certainly if you travel around the holidays, particularly over airlines, it gets very expensive. And if you're looking for a hot tip, flying on Christmas Day is actually cheaper than flying on, say, Christmas Eve or the day after Christmas. So if you're willing to have a bit of a non-traditional holiday where maybe you celebrate Christmas on the 26th or you celebrate Magi Day, I think you said, on January 6th, if you do it off that time a little bit, you might save thousands of dollars.
So what's it going to take, Matt, for your movement to give non-material gifts or gifts of experience or time to really take off, especially when you're bucking up against, you know, beautiful fall color Christmas display ads just about everywhere you look right now?
Well, I would hope that it's that I'm right. Can I say that? That people actually enjoy experiences more. They don't care about material goods as much. I think what's also going to happen is when we have another economic downturn, the shift is going to go away from materialism again. If you look at spending every single year on the holidays, it rises and falls pretty well with how well the economy is doing. That's why back in 2009, we spent half as much as we do now. When things get a little tighter, people tend to focus more on the cheap things, which often is the better stuff, like spending time with family.
In general, your advice to people about spending, I'm guessing, don't go into debt, save money. What are some suggestions you have before we close for how people can get better at saving and actually see the results of it in a way that is not just socked in the bank somewhere?
Certainly, as you said when we first started chatting, budgeting ahead of time can help, but I don't think many people like to budget. I don't think budgeting is for everybody. My preference is for people to set good habits. Start putting money away every single month into the savings account, even if it's only $10 or $20. That's better than nothing. Set these habits in motion without having to think about it. And over the long run, you're going to be that much better off.
And for year-end giving, this is something that a lot of people take advantage of. Is this the time to get that stuff together, or do you leave that until the week after Christmas?
Oh, gosh, when do I do that? 20 years ago? What did I do back then? I think that
good for New a tax Year's, write-off.
Yeah, New Year's is a good time to think about changing habits, to shift your gears a little bit. So if people want to wait until after the in-laws are out of the house and you can take a breather, sure, target this for something to do for New Year's. The idea, though, is to not have to keep thinking about this all the time. Set it and forget it. You'll have the money stashed away so that, hey, next year, if you do want to spend a lot on Christmas or on the holidays, you have the money there, and then you don't have to go into debt.
Okay, that's our resident ghost of Christmas, I guess, present and future, and financial educator, Matt Gorin. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Matt and Michael Gene Thomas are co-hosts of the WUGA podcast, Nothing Funny About Money. It's really terrific. We do advise you to subscribe, and we would love to hear from you. Do you feel pressured to go all out for holiday gifts, or are you giving time or homemade gifts instead, or bringing that bottle of wine over to a friend? You can tweet us. We're at OST Talk. You can leave us a voicemail. We're at 404-500-9457. That's all we've got for today. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back again tomorrow with more on Second Thought.